Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход» в том подъезде, как в поместье.
Greetings, listeners. Welcome to another edition of New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Kevin Rothrock, and I'll be your host today. Every podcast, I talk to an author about their new book on Russia or Eurasia. In this episode, I spoke with Richard Sock about his new book, The Crisis of Russian Democracy, The Dual State, Factionalism, and the Medvedev Succession. Sock's book comes at a moment in Russian political history when uncertainty is once again in the headlines and on the lips of experts and journalists. While Sock's book is principally about how Dmitry Medvedev became Russia's third president, the crisis of Russian democracy is more importantly an analysis of the institutions and dynamics that animate Russian politics today. Rejecting typologies of democracy with adjectives, as Sock calls it, like semi-authoritarian democracy or sovereign democracy or transitional democracy, he identifies competing institutions in Russia, the dual state, and studies them dynamically in order to document the interaction of various social and political forces. Sock's concept of the dual state describes the permanent struggle and imbalance between Russia's administrative regime and its constitutional state apparatus. Rooted firmly in the nitty-gritty details of Kremlinology and intrigue, Sock's methodology also allows him to explore the role that ideological norms play in Moscow high politics. The result is a fascinating medley of perspective, one that any scholar of Russia cannot help but find appealing. For more of this discussion, here's my interview with Richard Sakwa. We're joined today by Professor Richard Sakwa, renowned Russian expert and, among many impressive things, Associate Fellow of the Russian and Eurasia Program at the Royal Institute of International Affairs and Professor of Russian and European Politics at the University of Kent in the United Kingdom. Professor Sakwa has been publishing research about the Soviet Union and now Russia for more than two decades, and today he has joined us to discuss his 2011 book, The Crisis of Russian Democracy, The Dual State, Factionalism, and the Medvedev Succession, from Cambridge University Press. Professor Sakwa, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, before we dive into your book, I wonder if you wouldn't tell our listeners a bit about your background, where you were born and raised, and how, or perhaps why, did you come to study Russia professionally?
Mm. Yes, no, the family is basically from the Polish emigration. My father was a Polish reservist during the war, just at the beginning of the war in 1939. And after many adventures, he ended up with the Polish Second Corps with General Anders in Egypt and fought with the British Eighth Army in the famous battles at Tobruk, El Alamein, Benghazi, and then up to Monte Cassino, and was hoping to return to Poland in 1944-45. But of course, by then, the German occupation had given way to a Soviet occupation. And so he went back to Egypt, and basically, cutting a long story short, he, like thousands of other Polish officers and soldiers, ended up in emigration, ended up as a refugee in Britain. The Polish Nationality Act of 1948 allowed Poles to live and have full civic and human rights within Britain without actually taking British citizenship. Yeah. And I was born in that time. And so clearly, this was a whole generation waiting to go back to the motherland, to Poland in this case. And we used to, at home, in Norfolk, a county in the east of England, we would get, for example, journals were sent, Życie Warszawa, Life of Warsaw, in the 50s, 60s, and later with still in the way that the distinctive smell of socialism almost, where these journals would come, and it was one of my jobs as a small boy to take a sharp knife and to cut the papers, because in those days, journals didn't come, with pages which you could turn. You actually had to cut them. Oh. And so I would then look at the pictures of Warsaw being rebuilt. The destruction, as you know, was incomplete after the Warsaw uprising. And so it was always the question which concerned me is, why did I end up, because my first language was Polish, the question was always, why did we end up in England? What are we doing here? And that was a geopolitical, if you like, a political or a personal issue. Right. And also, of course, the other angle was always, what was the nature of this system? Because the Soviet relationship with Poland in the years of the Polish People's Republic was not simply one of occupation, because these occupying forces were rebuilding Warsaw. They were developing, they were building Nowa Huta, they were, you know, building housing and achieving huge social mobility, peasants moving to towns, within towns workers becoming officials, going up the social ladder, officials becoming Communist Party bosses. So this was a very peculiar system. I mean, it wasn't simply empire. In many ways, Poland benefited from this relationship with the Soviet Union. For the first time in history, it had safe, defensible borders. It wasn't in danger of being attacked by anybody. But obviously, it had lost a certain degree of sovereignty, and it had lost a certain degree of political liberty, which was the price to pay. But clearly, it was it couldn't just simply be called an exploitative relationship towards the end. Of course, it wasn't clear who was exploiting whom with cheap energy and other goods from the Soviet Union. And certainly, the Soviet Union had exported ex-security, above all, of a peculiar sort, of course. So these were the sort of issues, both in terms of geopolitical and in ideological terms, which exercised me for many, many years. I studied history at the London School of Economics, and that was one of those issues. And then after that, more specifically, I entered the PhD program at the Center for Russian and East European Studies at the University of Birmingham, where I was then had the opportunity to explore these questions in greater depth.
I see. Okay. And I'm curious, why go into, say, Russian studies as opposed to, you know, Polish studies now? Or was that just the nature of Soviet studies back when there was a Soviet Union?
In part, it was because my oldest brother, did take up Polish studies. So imagine he was equally exercised with his question. So we divided the world. He took Poland, and I said, you take Poland, and I'll take the Soviet Union.
Very
and
nice.
So a division of labor.
Right.
But I must say, I was always more interested in the Soviet Union. For some, I don't know why, but it always was to this day even, in a sense, because it was the source of the occupation. Poland, in a sense, obviously very interesting in its own way, but it was not the core of the system.
Right.
So I was fascinated by the core.
Okay.
And what the logic of which established the Soviet Union as a peculiar ideological and military and economic system.
Okay, all right. Well, the first thing I'd like to ask you about the book is how do you intend for it to be read? Who's your imagined audience? And also, what prompted you to write a book about Medvedev's succession, knowing that it would be published as his presidential term was coming to an end, at least the first one and the only one so far?
That, of course, I didn't quite know. I'll tell you, if I may, a secret on this book.
Mm-hmm.
It was, I used to call it The Accidental Book.
Okay.
Because I always like to feel, not to be too tied by particular plans and so on. So yeah. What seizes my interest and enthusiasm at a particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Because the book previous to that was the Yukos book, right. A book about the Yukos affair, Hodorkovsky. And so while doing this book, I was focusing on the Yukos book, but the events of 2007, as we came up to that election cycle, mm-hmm. parliamentary elections in December, presidential elections in March 2008,
mm-hmm.
it was just so fascinating because the tensions within the system became obvious, came to the surface. It was more than just, even though I do use the analogy of dogs fighting under the carpet, Churchill's alleged statement to that, mm-hmm. though I tried to find it, and I couldn't. But as I say in the book, the footnote on that, which is fascinating, I asked all the experts. But this was the accidental book because it was just so fascinating, and the book almost wrote itself,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that various chapters, various sections, as I was working and just trying to get a sense of things, would be writing away. For example, on succession issues in Russian politics over the years, which are fascinating, all the way back to the year 1019,
mm-hmm.
after the death of Vladimir and so on. That succession has always been a peculiar issue in Russian imperial and even then in Soviet history, and of course now to this day.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is the way they're shifting from one leader to the next. And more than that, it was just showed again the inner tensions and inner dynamics of Russian politics today. And this is when more and more, and at the core of this book, was this model of the dual state, that ultimately it gave us all sorts of questions. I mean, one of them, I'll go back to the dual state, is to say that I was very dissatisfied with the way that most of the writing about contemporary Russian politics takes place. Mm-hmm. Within a rather formal framework, you know, I'm in favor. I actually think that translogical comparative democratization approaches have a lot to say to us.
Mm-hmm.
But too often, these models are not dynamic. They talk about hybrid system, but they tend to be typological with endless democracy with adjectives,
right.
as people say, delegative democracy, or mm-hmm. electoral democracy, a whole stack of them, which are typological, I call them, or quite simply teleological. That is almost a sense of we know where we're going.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we don't have a clue where we're going when mm-hmm. it comes to Russia. And Russia, least of all, knows where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to get to develop, and this is the key part, the key methodological element about the book, is to get a dynamic model. That is to look at the genuine social forces, political forces, institutions, which are actually interacting with each other, indeed ideology, which are interacting with each other, to say that, to examine really what is going on, and not simply to just think that the job is done by simply putting it into a box, a category, that it's a semi-authoritarian system or whatever. But it's actually far more dynamic because it's all of these things at the same time.
Right.
And this is where the second point is key. There's a dynamic model, but the dual state, again, allowed me to say the fundamental tension is between the institutions, the constitution of 1993, which is a decent constitution. I know many people criticize it, and there's plenty of things to criticize about it.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, it works. Over 20 years, people have committed themselves to it. There's plenty of good lawyers and constitutional court judges and others who work genuinely within its framework. The constitution itself does have defined political weight. That even Putin, the fact, and this was fascinating, that Putin himself left after two terms in 2008
mm-hmm.
because of the constitution, which shows at least a certain, I mean, there are other reasons involved. He didn't want to become associated with the Belarus or Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I think it was a sense that, yes, this is the constitution. He could have changed it, but he actually stuck to it. And that I give him huge credit for that at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So the constitutional state on the one side, yet this administrative system on the other side, which is genuine. It developed under Yeltsin. My first article on the subject was in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite clear that 1996 came out in 1997, where you actually had this duality that the system, the regime, the vlast, if you like, as we call it, vlast, the authorities were subverting, suborning, and undermining the letter of the Constitution, though never repudiating it outright.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this dynamic model between these two basic subsystems within Russia today, the constitutional state, which has weight, you know, has work, does act as a constraint and as a shaper of political action,
mm-hmm.
and then the other side, the administrative system, which today more and more was includes the security forces, which really allow themselves more and more liberties. It was quite clear in the book, the episode with Cherkasov and others, mm-hmm. that it still then considered itself a knighthood.
Mm-hmm. So the two pillars of Russian politics, you know, what make up what you call the dual state? Like you said, it's this constitutional state on one side, and then it's this administrative regime on the other. Now, the president or the Kremlin is not actually in one of those camps. He is sort of maneuvering between them, right? Now, how exactly is the interplay working here? Because there is a dual state, but there's a sort of super state authority, right? And he's utilizing this dichotomy for his own benefit.
Yes, no, that's a very difficult question to answer because I constantly trying to envisage it. What I was trying to do is certainly to avoid simply saying that the presidency is head of this administrative system, because it's not under Putin, and even more under Medvedev, because the whole point about Medvedev was that he was appealing to the norms of the constitution, to international law, and so on. So the presidency itself is in part a hostage to this duality and caught between it. And of course, this is how under Putin, and indeed under Medvedev to some degree, they maintain their independence by not being captured by any wing of the dual state or even by any of the factions, the liberals, the Siloviki, the security people, the regional bosses. So the presidency and the Kremlin itself, and of course with the White House, the seat of the government, the prime minister with Putin, Putin occupied that for the last 4 years. Maintains itself, as it were, as a balancing force. This, on the one side, has a positive because it allows a certain amount of independence in policy making. The state or the Vlast has not simply been captured by any particular interest group or faction. On the other side, it's led, and more and more I'm arguing this, it isn't quite so strong in the book, it leads to some sort of stalemate and a dead end. You're absolutely right. The key point is that the presidency isn't simply an instrument of one or the other, but it maintains itself by balancing between the two.
The administrative regime, that's made up of what we might call political actors. I mean, that's where you have the factions and you have the bodies of state. Now, the constitutional state, can we consider that a group of actors, or is it more of a kind of, is it an abstraction that is sort of utilized by the various factions, or how can we sort of visualize or understand what the constitutional state is?
Yeah. Indeed. So, the administrative system has got a whole series of factions and these sort of quasi-political actors, parapolitical actors. The constitutional state is more based on institutions and the norms which they represent. So I stress that, because it is the institutions. We're talking about the Supreme Court, the Constitutional Court, the Arbitrage Court, the Commercial Court, that is. Also, institutions like elections, because it would be easy simply to say that these elections were fraudulent and so on. Of course, there's an element of that. But the fact is that the system every 4 years had this nervous breakdown as it comes up to these elections, because they realized they couldn't just simply fiddle them. Lots of fiddling going on, but they couldn't simply fiddle it. It's more than that. And at the same time, they have to go through with it, because they've lengthened the terms, but they have to go through with it, and it provides a sort of a collective nervous breakdown for the whole system, for the whole year that leads up to it. So that's a genuine institution. It's a constraint. Also, the constitutional state isn't just domestic. It's also, insofar as the Russian constitution claims, and it has huge effect. I mean, Russia is a member of the Council of Europe, and therefore the European Court of Human Rights is of profound effect. It's led to the abolition of the death penalty. It hasn't quite formally, the effective abolition of the death penalty, and many, many other things that justice can be sought. If it cannot be found within the country, then you go to Strasbourg to try to find it. And there's other elements. It's even, I've spoken to judges and so on who are genuinely trying to fulfill and work within the grounds. I mean, there's 4 million cases a year, court cases a year. The vast majority of them in Russia are normal. Unfortunately, in political cases, as we know, Basmani justice, as we know in the Yukos affair, that the courts are suborned and subordinated. And indeed, I'll talk about later about the next project, but it's just far too much of the court, and this is the great devastating legacy of the Putin years, have not been able to assert genuinely and universally their independence. And that is a catastrophic condition for Russia to be in.
And that has consequences beyond, I imagine, just the instances when there actually is interference in a sort of politicized case. It probably has reverberations.
Huge knock-on effect.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. The signal to all the others that you can get away with it.
Right.
Yeah. No, it's awful. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, in the book, you describe Medvedev as leading resistance to the administrative regime on behalf of this more genuine constitutionalism, these norms and so on. But to what degree did or does Medvedev represent his own factions in the regime, or did he gradually become more like the administrative regime by being president? Was that a sort of necessity that corrupted the project, or was he able to actually remain above the fray, so to speak, as Putin sort of ideally tries to be?
Yeah, he was always constrained. And the tandem is a reflection of Russian politics more broadly, and that is its refusal to define. And the key thing about the tandem is that you never quite knew what was what.
Right.
And this is why people got terribly frustrated with Medvedev, because he was playing everything. He himself got confused, of course, because I think that he came, and it was shown in later actions, a genuine commitment to strengthening the constitutional state, that is, against legal nihilism, which was his big slogan right at the beginning. And he genuinely wanted to do it. He strengthened the Presidential Council on Human Rights and what have you. Unfortunately, he was constrained. It wasn't even so much tandem, but it was by Putin's personal ambition, which I think where he, about 2 years ago, he became quite clear that he wanted to come back. He didn't tell Medvedev. The statement that it was all agreed 4 years ago, I think, is false. Everybody I've spoken to says it's false. Of course, it was one of the options for Putin to come back, obviously, and possibly even the number one option, but it was not decided. And even the last 2 years, I mean, I've seen Medvedev at close-up at the Yaroslavl Forum when he brought the great and the good and myself along to discuss the quality of democracy.
Right.
And where he made these very strong speeches. And it wasn't just a speech. I mean, I think he believed it, and he wanted to do it. And it isn't just me. People like Gleb Pavlovsky and Igor Jurgens and Yevgeny Gontmacher and others were quite clear that not only should Medvedev come back, because Putin's return would probably not be a good idea, least of all for himself, and that he should, and that he could come back. And it was a possibility. The decision for Putin to come back seems to have been taken last May 2011. And then after that, Medvedev was deflated. And he wasn't the same Medvedev, really, after that. We expected a big speech in the St. Petersburg Economic Forum, and it was a whimpered speech in Skolkovo and so on. So it was quite clear that Medvedev, funnily enough, everybody called him a political corpse after the castling move on the 24th of September 2011.
Right.
However, when we had the mass movement, the mass mass demonstrations against the falsification in the December election, Medvedev was almost beaming because it justified everything he'd been saying, and it gave him a second wind, a second political life. And so Medvedev very cleverly put himself effectively at the head of the popular movement for genuine free elections, for independent courts, to clean up the system and so on. So Medvedev as prime minister, the tandem continues now in a new form, still with unclear rules of the game, but the game is not yet over by a long chalk.
And so
that model of the dual state outlined before, in a sense, the tensions continue with the presidency, parliament, the indeterminacy, all of the funny games going on between and beyond the constitution.
And Medvedev, you'd say, is still pushing for these sort of constitutional norms as opposed to falling in with the administrative regime?
Yes. Of course, his position now, well, paradoxically, in institutional terms, of course, far weaker because he's now not the president. Nevertheless, in political terms, this he is stronger as long as the popular movement can continue. I don't think it will, unfortunately, because having spoken, just come back from Moscow and so on, that I kept saying to him, you've got to establish a popular democratic front to defend constitutional state, or I didn't quite use those words, but effectively that. Lots of people agreed with me, but they said it can't be done. But I said it's the only way to, because systems never like to give freedom and justice from above. Just like U.S. human civil rights movement, you had to have a mass movement, a big movement from below, a big push from below, for the U.S. even to fulfill the promise of its own constitution. And similarly, in Russia, you have to have a push from below constantly within the norms of the constitution. And so I also warn the leaders of this protest movement, it's no good making unconstitutional demands. The demand should be for the constitution to be fulfilled.
Right. Okay. Well, to bring it back to the book, a key moment seems to be one of Putin's early experiences with Gazprom, when they take an independent political stance in 1989 by supporting Lushkov and Primakov, when Putin is becoming prime minister and then president. Now, you identify this as a key reason that Putin turns to building up state officials' presence in major companies, which then contributes eventually to the Yukos affair, which aggravates the depoliticization of the public sphere. Now, how exactly does state corporatism fit into the dual state, and why was the Yukos affair such an important moment in the story of Putin bringing that about, or making it stronger, let's say?
Yes. Well, I have to say that in all of this, that Putin, I mean, has a type of vision of the developmental state. Mm-hmm. So you, I mean, whether it's called state corporatism, it certainly is that Putin does not like independent political actors. So what he spent the 10 years or above all of his power doing is making sure that no one could invade the privileges of this administrative system, which he himself keeps it subordinate action to himself, couldn't challenge this like they did in 1999 with Primakov and Lushkov, with the financial muscle power of Gazprom and some others. So he, and of course, when Hodorkovsky and Yukos was challenging this precisely, this return to 1999 in 2003, he, you know, moved decisively to stop it. And since then, after that, you have it. It isn't even state corporatism as such. It's a system in which people, the corporations, can get on and do it. Yes, they will build up national champions. That is, industries that would otherwise tend to disappear, like shipbuilding, like aircraft building, to leave the world just Boeing and Airbus industries dominant. But Russia still has a vision of itself as a player in all of these actors. Mm-hmm. So this is what, you know, again, one of those dualities which pervades contemporary Russian politics, because Putin does have this developmental vision. It's a rather old-fashioned one. It's an industrial policy. It's a French one of the 1950s and 1960s, dirigisme and the like. So it isn't quite state corporatism, but it's, you know, within that sort of, towards that end. At the same time, while he's developing this model, the other side of that duality is the intense, well, the conflict of interest by putting on state officials onto the board. But this conflict of interest, which elsewhere spills over into a prevalent corruption. Mm-hmm. So in a strange sort of way, I'm now beginning to say that the balance to all of this is, and I don't quite know what word to use to describe it, mm-hmm. but I'm beginning to think in terms of the third state and a deep state. In other words, that the deep corruption which has emerged to balance this developmental dynamism, mm-hmm. or developmental impetus, to put it that way, there is this element which is absolutely undermining entrepreneurship and business development, apart from the big corporations, which themselves are led by the cowed and tamed oligarchs who don't dare to exercise political power on their own, mm-hmm. apart from Mikhail Prokhorov. But even Prokhorov, in these last elections, somebody told me, in fact, I won't name whom, said that when Prokhorov was standing in the elections, he went to see Putin and said, "How far can I criticize you and a system?"
Right.
And Putin, as a sign of his political genius, said, "You decide for yourself." In other words, that self-limitation. Uh-huh. Brilliant. One should never underestimate Putin's genius and uh-huh. political noose on these occasions.
Right.
But what he failed to understand is that this system has bred a deep corruption. Even just now, in the meetings I had earlier today, somebody was telling me about a small business, well, quite a successful business, which was making a lot of money, employing several hundred people. And of course, then the security forces, the police came along and said, you know, give us a very large bribe, mm-hmm. 20 million rubles. And he refused. And they then took away his business perfectly legally using the courts,
mm-hmm.
Which is I'm developing work on that later. But this is what goes on all the time, that that even political cliché, political cover, no longer can protect you.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. It's an extraordinary degeneration of economic entrepreneurship, but of course of governance entirely, because of the undermining, the corrosion of the modern institute. So the undermining, indeed, of the constitutional state and its institutions. So I still believe, I mean, people say to me, when you talk about the crisis of Russian democracy,
mm-hmm.
I'm attacked on both sides. Those who say you know, what democracy? And those who then say, what crisis? There's fewer and fewer of those now, one has to say.
Right.
But what democracy? And it's coming, indeed, each year that passes, unless, because, yeah, to go back to Medvedev's point, that he, unfortunately, was unable to deliver on his promises of strengthening the constitutional state. And that is a tragedy, that because Putin vetoed it, stymied it, and blocked it at every opportunity, which was catastrophic. I think, above all, most catastrophic for Putin himself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A bit of a side question here. This caught my eye as an American reader. What's the significance of Putin's regular allusions to FDR and to America, comparing the Russia today to America during the Depression or World War II? Mm.
Yes. No, that's an interesting question. Of course, FDR was very much attacked, as we know, even by the courts in the 1930s. It was obviously FDR got huge respect in Russia because of his role in the Second World War and the alliance with Stalin against Nazi Germany. But more than that, it's to say that ultimately Putin has a strong vision of leadership. He does have a vision of a strong leader. And this is the other contradiction of Putin, that it's somebody who has the courage of his convictions, which, of course, FDR did in the, and also, of course, in particular, dealing with the crisis after the Depression in 1932-33 when he came into office. The fact that he boldly acted and got enormous amount of criticism and yet was able to shake the country and begin to move it out of depression. And with the political courage to do it. So Putin is not afraid of taking unpopular actions. Of course, he's very pragmatic and he's very careful. And that's a good sign of his, what I think is, you know, brilliant leadership. Whether it's effective and good leadership in a profound sense is another issue. But he certainly is a very able leader. And so he looks to people like Roosevelt, and of course now Stolypin, the prime minister between 1906 and 1911, and a number of other leaders, for example, Ludwig Erhard and Konrad Adenauer, and of course Charles de Gaulle, who also boldly in 1958 effectively undertook a constitutional coup to establish a Fifth French Republic. So FDR is among a small group of leaders whom Putin genuinely sees as people who are able to change the nature of politics in their societies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, to move into maybe minutia of the book, I want to know, how important do you think someone like Stanislav Bielkovsky is? Mm-hmm. And what does the Kompromat campaign that he facilitated against Putin in 2007 signify? And if that kind of Chorny PR can be tied to someone like Sechin, does that mean that various other initiatives like belonging to Bielkovsky or people that are potentially connected like him, does that mean that the Siliviki are potentially working plots to pressure Putin, not just kind of in the public sphere of Kompromat, but also potentially even organizing the opposition, actually, in a way that's meant to pressure Putin, like Bielkovsky's been involved in Russian nationalism as well. It's not just releasing, you know, compromising, facts or myths. It's actually mobilizing people on the ground to potentially sort of behave in a way that would change politics. Now, do you think that sort of thing is going on today?
I'm sure it is. It's very hard to get to, of course, the measure of it.
Right.
Bielkovsky, of course, was one of the people who wrote the article, The State and the Oligarchs, which signaled the beginning and gave the ideological cover for the attack against Yukos and Hodorkovsky in 2003. So Bielkovsky, as you see in the book, I did interview him. I did speak with him. And since then, I've spoken with him. He's obviously a very, very interesting and intelligent man, but as you say, it's not entirely clear where his ideas and information is coming from. Specifically the about the allegation that Putin is hugely wealthy, and suddenly to discredit Putin does suggest indeed that even Putin himself, and he's well aware of this, could be the target of his friends, because he never gives the Siloviki full dominance, full gain. He always tries to keep them. Yes, he balances them against other factions. But obviously, they then upset. I wouldn't even say it's Sechin personally, because Sechin, I think, is very loyal to Putin. But of course, at the same time, I'm sure he wouldn't be averse to putting a bit of discreet pressure on him. So it's, and the role of Bielkowski and other, these PR chicky, these public relations people,
right,
is extremely unclear. What suddenly emerges, though, is that somebody like Gleb Pavlovsky, who's just written a book on the, you know, genius power, my genius power, is, again, was beginning to show from the inside how the system worked and the way that they would try to change public consciousness of particular issues by shaping agendas and shaping the media coverage of a particular issue. It's now emerging how this is done from inside. And of course, Bielkowski was doing it from outside, because he's a bitterly disappointed man.
Right.
He never actually managed to get anything out of it, if you like, in any particular status and so on. So he ends up becoming almost a parody of himself, which I'm afraid is a tragedy of people who get disappointed in developing the way they would like to.
Okay. Now, you note that Putin, near the end of his second term, turned to anti-factional and anti-establishment appointments and public statements. Now, this is a symptom, I suppose, of the need to stay above the fray, the need to balance the constitutional state against the whims of the regime. Now, do you expect this to continue in the third term, or has there been some kind of hardening while he's been out of the Kremlin?
Yes. Whether, in other words, can Putin remain above the fray, above the factions, or will he ultimately become captured by one of them because of his weakened position?
Or maybe that, will he come to personify the regime, and then Medvedev will have to personify the constitutional state? Is that a possibility, or is that a recipe for disaster? Or is it both?
Yes. That's exactly it. That Putin could indeed be captured and become ultimately simply a symbolic of the endless fiddling and virtual politics of the administrative regime. And then that Medvedev more clearly delineates himself as a defender of the constitutional state, the rule of law, and so on. It would be an epical division if they came out into open conflict. Personally, I think that as long as it remained within the constitution, I think that if they were openly, if Medvedev had the courage to openly state, which he began to do over the Yukos affair over Libya, to openly give his opinion and to make it. In other words, to politicize factional conflict, to allow the emergence of it. I think it's unlikely, by the way, in the short term. Right. I think that Medvedev is and Putin are too careful and too closely bound with each other, because I think they have both got compromised on each other, is that it was unlikely to do it. But there could be other factional splits. However, as far as Putin is concerned, that he's weathered this political crisis of the elections, but he's not clear what he's going to do. So whether he's well aware, even he started talking about the need to combat corruption. He's well aware of the limitations and the fragility of his own power. And I think he got a bit of a shock in the last few months. It would be fantastic to see whether he can change. I don't think it's excluded, but the political situation he's led himself into, he's allowed this corruption. I've just mentioned the case of the police and security forces taking this small business, that he is aware of the need for what needs to be done now, but I think he's aware of the lack of instruments to achieve that. And the only instruments which were there before were the ones that Medvedev controlled, that is, the normative space, this commitment to free and fair elections. And this is so not Putin's style. That this is why I always felt that Medvedev was a better person to carry out the strengthening of the constitutional state. Paradoxically, in a purely political sense, the tragedy or the interesting moment now is that Putin has to fulfill Medvedev's agenda.
Right.
Having pushed Medvedev out from the presidency, the agenda which Medvedev outlined is the only one that can lead Russia out of its contemporary crisis.
How conscious do you think state actors like Putin or Medvedev or really anybody at a high level like that? How conscious are they of their tasks as a sort of as existing in an existential crisis, the way we're kind of talking about it? Or do they look at it more as a series of administrative decisions that are sort of routine and need to be made in the best interest of the state after calculations and so on? Or are they, do you think they approach their agenda, having, you know, now that they're beginning on new ones, having just taken up new positions, as are they looking at their work as the state is in, you know, the country is in a state of crisis, we're on the brink, we need to kind of look at our work in terms of the dual state? Or is it for them, would that be a strange position to take?
Yeah, we'll find that out in the next few weeks.
Right.
whether indeed I think they're well aware of the challenges that face them, because they can't have simply rely on high energy rents and so on in perpetuity. And so whether they're aware of the economic and other crises that they face, whether they can now, if you like, de-escalate the rhetoric of the election campaign, right, which Putin, it wasn't Medvedev, talking about danger, dangers to the state of external intervention and so on and so forth. Whether he can, if you like, to achieve a de-securitization of all of this, to achieve that. However, I think that Medvedev understands intellectually the overwhelming danger of it, but I don't think Putin does. That I think that his articles, which he was coming out, the seven campaign articles, were absolutely fascinating, but they didn't show the fundamental challenge, which is to strengthen the institutions rather than his personal leadership. So the danger is that Putin may try to strengthen the regime, that is, it's the so-called vertical of power, which doesn't really exist, which is a vertical of power. People misunderstand, sometimes think it's the strengthening of the state. It was not. Putin constantly weakened the state, and it became a power vertical focused on administrative arrangements, whereas the state, of course, is a far more complex thing, which is a combination of institutions and norms, and indeed people's personal loyalty and so on, whereas the operative code within the administrative regime is greed, venality, personal favors, informality. In a constitutional state, it is the more normal, indeed, senses of patriotism and altruism and all the other elements. And Putin cannot tap into that at the moment, other than in a rather, organized, instrumental way. And so this is why, say, Putin 3 at the moment sometimes I think he's going to, the whole thing is going to end in catastrophe, and that the a personal catastrophe above all, and that unless he can really change himself, unless Medvedev can convince him where and what to do in terms of strengthening the rule of law, independence of the courts, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And so the crisis now, the crisis that you would identify in Russian democracy today, is that seems to be founded on the reality and maybe more importantly the perception of endemic corruption. Now, is the evidence of that, aside from the fact that there is this corruption that can be verified in several ways, is the important thing that there are these protests now, or is there something else? Is it opinion polls, or what are you thinking of when we talk about the crisis facing Putin? Are we meant to think about people running out of the streets like they're doing now, but presumably in greater numbers, or is it the budget collapsing or the bottom falling out, or what would you kind of list as the factors there?
Yes. Yeah. So indeed, what are the game changers, if one wants to put it that way? The demos, I think that they're going to fade away, which I think is a shame. I mean, they talking to people in Moscow, there's a sense that they're running out of steam anyway. This last one on the 6th was something. And unfortunately, it wasn't able to establish a permanent institution which could continue pressure from below. The budget and other issues are important, but I don't think catastrophic. I really don't. I think so. It is the degeneration of governability, because of the ways that these actors now are becoming more and more concerned about their own short-term interests. So making money and stashing it abroad, because even those who steal internally no longer have faith in the viability and continuity of the Putin system. Mm-hmm. So even they are now making absolutely sure. I mean, the $35 billion left Russia in the first quarter of 2012, which is even higher proportion than last equivalent quarter last year. Mm-hmm. So it's accelerating. So it's quite clearly that there's the degeneration of governance, of belief in the future, even. So emigration, there's a number of issues. I don't think we should exaggerate it, because in a sense that the constitutional state, the government, still works relatively effectively. Mm-hmm. That one shouldn't forget that. This is why I've always said that the constitutional state, that the ministers, the ministries, all of that, they're all there. They're all working very increasingly professional civil service with reasonably sensible ministers. I don't condemn them, the cabinet of ministers. So, you know, they've got a number of exceptionally talented individuals there, Nabiullin and others, you know, these are very smart people. And I, even Shuvalov, despite his recent scandals, you know, he's a very effective and competent, and I actually think, ultimately, the honest minister. Mm-hmm. So, this is why I say it's always that duality, that we should always balance this degenerative capacity with regenerative capacity, which is there within the system, unless it squanders this opportunity, which is, of course, the major danger now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you write that one of the greatest accents on Russian democratic decline has been the marginalization pace of the old democratic movement and systemic opposition, which has exceeded the creation of new oppositionist centers. Now, is that still true, or sort of turning back to the protests, not to belabor them, but does that indicate that maybe these older parties are possibly catching up, or that they're recovering some kind of past relevance? Parties like Yabloko and maybe the communists Russia is still kind of in a self identity crisis, I suppose. But some of their deputies are kind of at the forefront of at least the street demonstrations. Now is that going to win them a kind of actually like a real popular identity, or is it at least possible? Is it going to fix that imbalance somewhat? What do you think?
Mm. It seems almost that this regime or the system, the Vlast, is hell-bent on undermining every source of internal renewal. It alienates its own supporters more than anybody else. The changes to the party system as a result of the protests means that it's going to become exceptionally easy to create a political party. So this could lead to not the old parties like the Communist Party, the Just Russia, as you said, which is did very well in the parliamentary election. So Mironov, its leader, did very badly in the presidential election. Instead of allowing those to develop, and maybe a handful of other parties, what we're going to now have is hundreds of small parties, including possibly the fragmentation of Just Russia itself into its various factions. And I think United Russia will more or less stay together for the time being, at least. So we're going to see, instead of the party system becoming a source of renewal, it'll become, again, a source of fragmentation and will be unable to give leadership to the popular movement and indeed to formulate genuine popular programs for the renewal of Russian politics. So, as I say, it's almost like a death wish that they've done this for short-term political ambition to undermine the protest movement, to fragment and segment it, and instead of which they could have looked to political parties to genuinely support them, because they could have built a coalition of independent political party. But the administrative regime hates genuine political conflict. It hates genuinely independent political positions and political actors. So as for the party system, which of course is one of the changes to it, is one of the outcomes of the mass protest, it's instead of using that to support change, it's going to be using that just simply to the short-term survival of the regime.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the fact that one of the key elements of the party reform, as I understand it, is that there will not be party blocks allowed, and so that is what's going to that'll encourage the fragmentation to the point of kind of massive marginalization. Now, do you think that was something that Medvedev sponsored, or was it kind of the, was the regime poisoning the reform that he proposed?
Yeah, I think that it was the regime, but Medvedev went along with it. And again, that's one of the things which we could say in his, I mean, there's plenty of things you could say in his defense, but that's certainly one thing you could say in his incrimination for going along with, you know, these sort of, it's not even half-hearted, these instrumental short-term reforms, which really are not allowing these reforms to provide a genuine chance for the renewal of the system. However, on the other side, the restoration of gubernatorial elections is another aspect which I think does allow an opportunity for renewal. It will allow genuine competition, even though there's municipal filters and there is a weaker presidential filter. Nevertheless, I think that with great difficulty, no independent politicians will be elected. It will certainly liven up regional elections in the Russian political scene and possibly allow a renewal of political forces from below being elected in certain places as governors. So it's, again, as always, there's plenty of action going on, but it shouldn't just simply be dismissed as all cosmetic and so on, because the Vlast, the authorities, are not all-powerful, all-knowing, and plenty of their actions are going to have consequences which they did not anticipate So the whole this attempt to manage reform could lead to, in fact, genuine reform.
Now, the regime sort of getting its way or succeeding in undermining the reforms with political parties and, say, a kind of victory or limited victory for constitutional norms in the restoration of gubernatorial elections, does that indicate different priorities of these dualities of the state, or is that just kind of how the chips fell? Are the constitutional actors, are they kind of making a priority of taking the fight to the regions, and the regime is sort of settling in the capital? I mean, are we getting that kind of is that how the lines are breaking down? What do you think?
In fact, to some degree, the opposite, because, of course, Putin and Medvedev has lost the cities. Their election was very weak. And so they were trying to go to what some people call Russia 2, that is the blue-collar workers in the industrial Urals and elsewhere. At one moment in the election campaign, it looked almost as if this would be mobilized against the cities, the intelligentsia, the service workers, the IT workers, the iPad generation, and so on. In other words, Internet Russia against television Russia, where some people put it. But I think that as for these reforms, I think that to a degree it is how the chips fell. I don't think you can look at it. Yes, there was a lot of pressure to ensure that these gubernatorial elections did at least weren't quite so filtered as the, or so negative in their possible consequences as the reform to the party system. As also, of course, we're talking about possible reforms to the Federation Council, the upper house of the Russian Parliament, the Senate, and indeed there's going to be electoral reform, which no one, I asked a few people in Moscow last week, can explain how it is planning to work. This is the division of the country into 450 constituencies and so on and so forth. It's absolutely extraordinary how, or 250, but how they're planning to work it out. It's absolutely extraordinary. No one understands the system. And that certainly is an attempt. They're trying to be too clever by half.
I see.
And so that, I'm sure, will be changed by the time it comes into law.
I wanted to quote a line from the very end of the book, actually, before the conclusion, and sort of ask for a little bit more about it. You write that Medvedev was unable to mobilize the normative resources that were potentially available to him to achieve political and legal renewal, and instead he equivocated, generating disappointment and eventually anger. Now, disappointment and anger, you wrote this before the street protests broke out, but these are the two sort of emotions that are most associated with both the castling, I think, and the parliamentary elections, and I suppose also the presidential elections, although perhaps to a lesser extent. Now, are you talking about mass? Is this a popular mass disappointment and anger, or does it also belong to other groups or more narrow groups or something?
Certainly, there is disappointment within the elite.
Right.
We saw that from late 2010. The sacking of Lushkov was quite an important event, but he by then was becoming quite a critic, though after his dismissal, obviously far stronger. At the same time, Kudrin, Minister of Finance, in the beginning of 2011, was quite clearly outlining an alternative. Jürgens, I've mentioned before, and so on. So they were disappointed. As for the anger, there is an intense frustration, and I was picking this up even at the congresses of, well, Yaroslavl, this meeting which was headed by Medvedev, and even, you know, meeting and talking with United Russia members and even loyalists to the system. They themselves were getting disappointed by simply saying that this tandem, the lack of definition of really what it was all about. It was just, these fine words weren't being translated into effective actions.
Mm-hmm.
So it was building up. So while these protests, as you say, were very important from the end of 2011, there were already signs, for example, over the Khimki Forest motorway building in a protest. And there were the Blue Bucket movement in and
sure.
before that. And so there was, it's been building up for some time
mm-hmm.
that this isn't even just from the monetization of benefit protests in 2005.
Right.
But after 2007-8, a sense that even then, stagnation tendencies, disappointment, mm-hmm. and indeed anger was building up, and it exploded in
2011-12. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're grateful for your time today, and I know we need to let you go, but perhaps before we do that, you could tell our listeners a bit about what you're working on at the moment.
There's two things. I was planning to work on what I hinted at before,
mm-hmm.
and that is to examine in some depth the way that this third state has been developing, or the corrupt state. This is and focusing on the concept of raiding.
Mm-hmm.
Yukos, of course, was a massive raid of the state against this independent business. But this phenomenon, which takes place all the time, where we end up today with 1/8 of business people in Russia have had legal action taken against them by the authorities,
mm-hmm.
in most cases unjustified.
1/8 of the entrepreneurs or of?
Yes, 1/8.
Right.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You're talking about tens of thousands
right.
of business people are in jail,
mm-hmm.
that they've lost their business and lost their liberty.
Right.
This is absolutely amazing and a phenomenon which I would like to study.
Mm-hmm.
The way that the courts, even when the courts take away, I mentioned this business earlier in which the police came to this business and said, give us 20 million rubles. The businessman refused and they then said, well, we're going to take your business away.
Right.
They did it perfectly legally. Well, illegally legally. They took it to the court.
Mm-hmm.
The judge knew that the decision was unjust, yet passed it because he was under huge pressure, and passed a court decision which transferred the ownership of this business to the people who were seizing it, raiding it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, the Magnitsky case, the Hermitage Capital, is one of the most signal events of that sort.
Right.
So that's what I was going to look at. However, just again, like this book, The Crisis of Russian Democracy, was an accidental, though when I say accidental,
mm-hmm.
I think it actually reflects a very deep Zakonomernost, or how can I put it, deep logic of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing another sort of accidental book, and that is one which I'm very enthusiastic to do,
mm-hmm.
and that is going to look at the Putin phenomenon today,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be called the Putin and the Politics of Contradiction,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to not cover the earlier years of Putin, maybe just briefly, but it's going to look at, take the story on from the crisis of Russian democracy 2007-08,
mm-hmm.
look in some depth at the failures and achievements of the Medvedev years, at least in setting an agenda,
mm-hmm.
and then to examine how the Putin presidency will fail, because
mm-hmm.
I'm feeling that it will fail
mm-hmm.
in one form or another. Or certainly, unless it transforms itself, it's going to end rather badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to, even if it doesn't, it's only to examine what led Putin to come back, what forces, in other words, to continue the crisis of Russian democracy,
right.
But now focusing on the Putin leadership.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us here today. And I wish you the best of luck with those two projects. It sounds like at the pace you're going, there might be four that emerge. Who knows? But I hope they're all as wonderful as the crisis of Russian democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Richard Sokol about his book, The Crisis of Russian Democracy, The Dual State Factionalism and the Medvedev Succession. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Once again, I'm Kevin Rothrock, your host for New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. If you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com and be sure to tune in again for future interviews by me and my co-host Sean Guillory. Many thanks for listening. Until next time.